today, the deficit filler doesn't meet the cliff. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, Wealth Notice Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by journalist Tarek Brooker. Hi, Tarek.
Hi, Martin. How are you, mate?
Yeah, very good. How are you going?
Yeah, not too bad. Just, you know, watching the whole thing unfold.
It is one of those very long soap operas, isn't it? With, you know, every day they roll on new characters, new ideas, or old ideas. Boy, the statement yesterday really does highlight, I think, the significant issues we face. And frankly, it left me with more questions than answers.
Yeah, well, you're not the only one. I mean, that seems to be a theme that's running through the entire economics and finance community. A lot of people were saying, you know, a lot of it was very ambitious. A lot of it was very optimistic. And there doesn't really seem to be much more of a plan aside from the current, you know, continuation of, you know, deregulation of, you know, workplace relations laws and, you know, all that sort of stuff that they've already spoken about.
Well, of course, it wasn't a budget. It was a statement. So maybe they can explain that they'll be coming out in October with a plan. But it does worry me a little bit insofar that we know a few things. We know that the amount of debt will be as higher than it's ever been. We know that unemployment will be higher than it's ever been. And we know that it's based on a whole series of very, I think, optimistic assumptions about what COVID is likely to do. And, you know, the 9.5% unemployment number is probably understated the real number, but that's a lot higher than it's been, right? And the fact of the matter is that until the virus is tamed, all of these numbers basically are just made up, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, I saw these figures this morning from Alex Joyner from IFM Economics asking the ABS to clarify what the true rate of unemployment was, because Josh Frydenberg and Scott Morrison have been talking about that number a lot in their press conferences lately. And he came to the conclusion that once you sort of factor in all the various factors, that it's about 16%. And that's a fairly sort of, you know, rubbery figure compared with, you know, what we're seeing from the government. And there doesn't really seem to be much of a sort of cohesive narrative of where do we go from here. It's just sort of, this is where we're at, this is where we want to go, but we don't really know how we're going to get there.
Right. But what we do know is that we need growth to be able to grow our way out of the debt. I mean, that's basically the thing that came over to me, and I was watching the press address just now. And, you know, it seems to me that that's basically the get out of jail card, is that, well, if we grow the economy strongly enough for long enough, then effectively the debt will be repaid and reduced. But how are we going to do that, right? Where's growth going to come from? We've got no inward migration. Population growth locally is going to be very low, according to the latest numbers. And the question that I keep coming back to is, you know, is just banking everything on future growth without having a plan to get there really a sensible strategy?
No, it's not. But to be completely honest, we didn't really have a sensible strategy before the entire crisis began. You know, like I read these statements from the RBA last year, you know, talking about the wealth effect, talking about, you know, how we've got to lower rates to be able to spur economic growth. And it has nothing to do with, you know, promoting business lending or, you know, encouraging innovation or all those other things that, you know, most successful countries do. And I think that's one of the things that's the most concerning about this entire affair, is that all we're trying to do is go back to the way things were in January. We're not making a sort of, you know, big grand plan like we're sort of seeing in the UK or elsewhere, maybe in parts of Europe. We're just, let's get back to houses and holes and importing, you know, hundreds of thousands of migrants each year. And that's pretty much it. And I think that that's really, it's really quite worrying. You know, I mean, here we are, you know, we're 4 months into this crisis. It's been roughly 4 months since, you know, since Scott Morrison first announced all these various policies when Australia first went into lockdown. But what's changed? What sort of policies, what sort of plan do they have to get us out of this? Because I really don't think the status quo, the pre-COVID status quo, is going to be able to grow our way out of this because, you know, as you've made the point numerous times, retail and the rest of the economy was already weak.
Yeah, and I think it's just worth, you know, reflecting again. The economy was already in a downward spiral before COVID hit, right? So we were already seeing unemployment rising. We were seeing a number of retail businesses already folding. We were seeing slowing momentum in terms of construction approvals, all of those things. And what really has happened with COVID is that it's basically been a catalyst to just tear the elastoplast off the wound, as it were, and show just how bad it is. But yeah, just going back to the pre-COVID view of the economy and saying, well, we'll just do the same again like we did over the last 5 or 6, 8 years, whatever it is, it's not going to cut the mustard. It's really, we need a completely different way of thinking, because unless we can actually work on a strategy which says that future growth is going to be based on economic activity for real things like, you know, businesses that actually make things and create things, rather than just inflating home prices some more and throwing some more debt out there, we are going to find it ever so difficult to be able to push the economy in the right direction. And I still come back to the fact that a number of small businesses in my surveys are basically saying, well, you know, it's really going to be very difficult for me to access the job keeper because I can't necessarily commit to the things that they need me to commit to. And I think more small businesses are going to disappear. So, yeah, where is the real entrepreneurial support that I think is required?
It's not there, is it? You know, I mean, there's just no real vision. We just have what we have. And, you know, they just want to return things to the way it was before. And I find it quite interesting because it's not like there isn't an appetite in the Liberal Party and amongst the people who support the Liberal Party to really make major changes. You know, a lot of people I've spoken to, rank and file members of the Liberal Party, have said to me, why don't we spend, you know, all this money we're spending on JobKeeper, all this money that we're spending on all these other programs on kickstarting manufacturing, on, say, creating zones where, you know, you have preferential taxation. If a company wants to move here, move its production base here, or any number of other programs, but there's just no appetite for it from the government. You know, I read these things from the COVID, you know, Economic, you know, Recovery Commission, and it's just, oh, let's just do Work Choices 2.0. Let's deregulate industrial relations more. You know, let's talk about, you know, I mean, you had Frydenberg today saying Reagan was going to be one of his, you know, sort of inspirations for all of this. And I just feel like saying, so what? We're just going to try to trickle down economics all over again so we can sit here in 5 years and talk about how it hasn't worked again.
Yeah, well, we've seen that film a few times, and I don't think that doing the same thing again and expecting a different outcome makes any sense at all. But I guess there's another point I want to make, is that we've actually got laid bare the impact of insecure work. And I think it's worth just reflecting on what's happening in Victoria, where we've got people who essentially are trying to trade off, you know, keeping out of circulation because they might have the virus, vis-a-vis if they do that, then they don't earn. And that means they can't put food on the table. And I think the question about the structure of the workforce and the amount of insecure work, part-time work, multiple part-time jobs, is really the thing that needs to be thought about more than almost anything else. Because the trouble is that it looks to me as though they want to do more of that, not less of that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that there are a number of different sort of changes that have happened in the economy, you know, sort of the rise of gig employment, the popularity of that, the way businesses have embraced that type of employee relationship. But it's also just a lot of other things that really haven't been considered. You know, like I think about something like automation going forward. You know, the last, you know, recovery, you know, from the 90s recession to get unemployment back to where it was before the recession took 8 years. You know, so we've got an 8 year period, you know, potentially if it takes as long, 8 years from now, automation is going to be a hugely significant factor in how things are going to play out for our labor market. You know, I look at, say, someone like Woolworths, someone who generally employs unskilled workers. You know, they're talking about automating their warehouses. And, you know, that's going to cost jobs. And if people embrace that, it's just going to create more and more problems for the labor market. And I think as the labor market struggles more and more, it's only going to lead more businesses to even further casualize the workforce and even further embrace the gig economy, because they don't want to have to commit to hiring some form of, you know, full-time or part-time staff who they're going to have to provide these benefits for and just basically take that risk in this environment.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with that. And did you notice in the statement yesterday, there was a very important little section there saying that businesses are unlikely to invest at the moment because they can't necessarily see where future growth is going to come from. And so if they're not going to invest and they're going to try and survive, then clearly the only other thing to do is to press down wages even more.
Absolutely. And I look at the government's, you know, sort of increase in the small business lending program, you know, the government subsidized loans. And, you know, I've spoken to representatives of the banks, and none of what they've said to me in any way reflects the positivity and the hype coming from the government. You know, they've said that our lending standards remain relatively the same as pre-COVID. They're not really interested in relaxing them, because at the end of the day, I mean, what they said to me is, you know, it's all well and good for the government to say, oh, well, we're going to wear half the losses. And they're just like, well, we have to wear the other half, and we don't want to do that. Yes. So we're only going to lend to people who have positive prospects. You know, we're going to continue, and they use their favorite word, we're going to continue to lend prudently.
Yeah, well, of course, I guess you want banks to be prudent, but bearing in mind that this was a $40 billion program and they've lent, what, $1.5 billion so far, you can see how much of a success that's been.
Yeah, well, I mean, if this is the way things are going to be, then perhaps they should listen to you and Robbie Barwick and start up a government development bank so they can be the ones who do it.
Yeah, well, it's that we need to find a way to get support and funds to businesses who have the capability to be able to create the value into the future. I mean, that's essentially, you know, what's required. And I don't think the private banks will be able to do that, which is why, of course, we are advocating a public entity. And it goes back to, you know, what happened in the previous couple of times when there was a need for massive reconstruction and growth. It actually came from significant investment from a public bank that allowed then businesses to grow, thrive and develop. Because if you use standard commercial lenses to assess whether to lend or not, particularly when they're more risk averse than ever at the moment, then you just don't get the right outcomes. And, you know, you don't want just to create zombie firms for the sake of it, but you do also want to have a path to allow businesses to innovate, grow and develop. And I think there are lots of opportunities in Australia if we did but see it. And I showed one of my YouTubes recently, I showed to somebody over in Western Australia who actually was trying to run a business, believe it or not, installing solar powered street lamps. But the story about how difficult that was and how he found it very difficult to get the appetite and the funding illustrates the problem. And I get that again and again and again. Businesses find it really difficult, particularly small businesses find it really difficult to be able to jumpstart, not because of lack of ideas or lack of ability, but simply because of the commercial construct that actually exists in the country.
That's one of the fundamental problems of Australia. You know, all you've got to do is look at that classic graph of how much of total bank lending is dedicated towards residential mortgages. And it's a comparison and between all the various nations. And Australia is just absolutely up the top, you know, lending almost two-thirds of all bank lending for residential property. And you look at these other countries and, you know, some of them are down around about sort of 20 to 30%, which is sort of the international sort of median. And it just boggles the mind. I mean, I hear stories from people, like I heard from a friend a few years ago, and they said that someone they knew was developing a sort of revolutionary type of electric motor for electric cars. And they spent years and years here in Australia going to the banks, trying to get venture capital, trying to get someone to invest, and they got nowhere. They hopped on a plane with their last couple of $1,000s to America, went to a trade show. They had an investor and a partner within 48 hours. You know, they've got that can-do attitude there. And here in Australia, it's like, why would you want to do that? You can just buy 5 negatively geared investment properties.
Well, of course, that is the problem, that property has been seen up to this point as the secret source for wealth and everything else and prosperity and all those good things. Unfortunately, I think that's probably becoming a questionable strategy now, based on what I'm seeing at the moment. But of course, it's already too late, because the deflection of investment away from the commercial sector and from the business sector has been there for so long. And we've just got a very small base then of opportunity to create new things. And that's, I think, what we should be thinking about. I think the other side of it is that, interestingly, of course, with properties, we're now starting to see more and more mainstream economists talking about property price falls. And I was reading one today that said, well, we probably won't see any property price rises till, you know, 5-6 years down the track. And there's more information coming out about default levels and all of those things. So we can, I think, begin to see that side of the house wobbling quite significantly. And think about the implications then on the banks of that, because at the moment they've got a bit of a holiday with regards to not having to recognise losses at the moment, thanks to APRA. But the chances are that down the track, and particularly when they start ringing up people and saying, well, you know, are you going to start repaying your mortgage or not? And if not, they're going to have a hard conversation. I think the next few months there will be very significantly dire, and that's going to put more pressure on the banks, so they're going to be less able to lend to the commercial side of the house as a result of that too. So again, it comes back to, we need a different strategy.
I think we're in a really sort of strange position at the moment. Like, I feel like there's, on one hand, there's this sort of positive narrative going around in the media, going around from the government, that, you know, we're going to get through this, that it's going to be sort of relatively okay. I mean, I saw this article in Reuters today saying that they're, you know, that there's a prediction that Q4 is going to be positive. And I look at it and I go, how is that possible? Like, I don't know, like, maybe I'm missing something, or, you know, maybe, you know, there's some higher order thing going on that I don't completely fathom. But I look at the withdrawal of stimulus from the economy, you know, the withdrawal of JobKeeper or of the JobSeeker supplement, of all those various things as it gets tapered, of the fact that we're not going to see anywhere near the same level of super withdrawals in Q4 as we did in Q3. You know, I mean, we saw $10 billion go out the door in 9 days, and there's the start of July. And I just want to sort of ask someone of your knowledge and experience, how can we have a positive Q4 when they're pulling $50 billion out of the economy?
Well, of course, the iron ore price will save us. That's basically what I think people are thinking about, because, of course, the iron ore price is actually quite high, and the ABS data today showed that, in fact, the preliminary trade data looked pretty positive. So there are some, you know, points that actually still provide some strength. But of course, that doesn't help. That doesn't help really in terms of actually laying the foundation for future growth. And the risks are that the iron ore demand eases, or other countries like Brazil comes back online again. So it's a very tenuous basis on which to build a future economy. And look, a lot of the economists are still sucking the old the Kool-Aid, and indeed many now are starting to swallow the MMT, right? As the, you know, it's fine, you know, we can just create more money and you know, flow that into the economy. It's interesting, of course, Phil Lowe earlier this week in a speech basically said, well, he's got some reservations about taking that too far because there are some risks attached to it. Good on him for saying that, I think. But the fact is that many people still don't really want to understand the reality of where we are. And I always say, first thing, let's be clear about where we are. Let's not try and obfuscate it. Let's not try and just paint such a positive picture. We need to have a baseline that's firm so that we can then actually start to plan beyond it. But you see, I think it comes back to ideology, frankly, and probably political ideology at that, because I always come back to the fact that probably the next election is, you know, October, just over a year away, you know, a year and a quarter away. So what they'll be wanting to do is to try and support the economy as best they can through to the next election, so that they can at least say, well, you know, things aren't too bad, and then they can talk in glowing terms under election conditions of what they're going to plan to do the next few years down the track, right? So I think that's the first lens. The second lens is the ideology, which is that the neoliberal philosophy, which is driving all of this, continues. And basically that means that it's all about corporates and about corporate tax and those things. And, you know, basically the consumer is an engine of consumption, and that the outcome is GDP growth, when in fact maybe even GDP as a measure of anything isn't that useful.
No, it realistically, it's not. I mean, you know, you look at sort of, you know, real household income, you know, per capita over the last, you know, how, I think it's about eight or 9 years now, has been awful. Yep. You know, we've basically gone nowhere. And if you compare it in the run up to the GFC and even in a few years post, you know, we had extremely, extremely strong growth. And then the GFC basically just killed it. And then we've just sort of stagnated and gone along the bottom. But, you know, obviously headline GDP has been pumped up by things like, you know, government deficit spending and also, you know, high levels of immigration. So, I mean, realistically, I don't even know why we still talk about it, to be completely honest with you. You know, I look at these articles in the media that say, oh, GDP is going to be this much, GDP is going to be that much, and, you know, down the road. And I mean, say, for example, 18 months from now, we do get immigration going again. Of course, GDP growth is going to be fantastic. We're going to import 300,000 people a year then. You know, it's right. And not only that, but we're going to have a whole bunch of temporary visa holders come back. Of course, it's going to be good. But at the end of the day, is that really going to improve things for the average person on the street? And I just look at some of these unemployment figures, you know, even as it stands, without even the end of JobKeeper and more people losing their jobs. And, you know, it sort of makes the 1990s recession look like a tea party by comparison.
Well, it does, unfortunately. And, you know, what I find interesting is that if you talk to real households, as I do in my surveys, a lot of them recognise the pressures and recognise that things are not flash. But there's a different narrative there amongst real people compared with the political class and what the establishment are wanting to talk about, right? And what I'm concerned about is that there seems to be a gap in the middle, because essentially the mainstream media tend to be siding more with talking about what the government wants to talk about. In other words, they are a reflector of what the government's narrative is, rather than actually really getting to grips with what it's really like amongst real people. And I find that really worrying, because what it basically then means is that there's a feedback loop between the media and the politicians, and that sort of conversation goes on over there. And in the real world, as it's like, you know, the real frontline experience of people, as they sit around the barbecues or do whatever they do, it's just completely a different world.
I think that it really just indicates, you know, just how to speed the economy, and not only the economy itself, but also the narrative surrounding the economy has become. You know, like you look at, say, for example, you know, one of my favorites is the ANZ Weekly Consumer Confidence Survey. You know, when people as a whole look at the economy, they look at it and they go, oh my God, this is awful. This is terrible. But then by the same token, then the media says everything's fine. But then the people turn around and they think, well, it is bad. The economy is bad. But my household's going to be okay. I'm going to be all sweet. And I think that is really one of the most dangerous things in all of this. Because if people's confidence was down and people were taking this seriously, then I think, okay, you know, and then I think we could sort of hit rock bottom and then sort of grow our way out of it. Just sort of, we've accepted the reality. We know how bad things are. And then we can all get together and we can figure this out. But I think that the really dangerous thing is, you know, in Q4, we're going to see the withdrawal of all of this stimulus, tens of billions of dollars. And then the narrative finally has to stand on its own. People finally have to think, you know, okay, my household's going to be okay. But then what's going to happen when all this stimulus is removed? What's going to happen by sort of Q1 next year? You know, we're going to have all of these households who were promised this bridge to the other side, who genuinely believed it, even if it was only for their own household and immediate family, who believed that the economy is going to be okay, and then it's not going to be okay. And it's going to completely shatter this perception of things. And I think that's more dangerous than anything.
Well, it is, because what it basically means is that everything's being pushed off But, you know, all of those pressures effectively then are building up, which means that when the reality does dawn, it's going to be a more significant impost on people. And, you know, the Melbourne Institute survey that came out the other day said that only around 40% of people were more confident than less confident than previously, and that their intention to spend was lower rather than higher even now. So, you know, if you look at real data from real households, it's already looking pretty dodgy. But there's a question I wanted to ask you was, what should the opposition be doing then in this environment? Because frankly, they've gone missing in action as far as I can see.
Yeah, they really have. There was that ad from Albo the other day, you know, going after Josh Frydenberg for saying there's definitely going to be a surplus. And let's be honest, that was a pretty stupid mistake on their part.
Mm.
But realistically, they're wedged. That, you know, the Morrison government has basically, at least, you know, more broadly and on paper, abandoned the sort of, you know, fiscal management and, you know, sort of fiscal prudence ideas of governance. And that's really wedged the Labor Party because, you know, what can they turn around and say? Oh, we're going to spend even more money. But I think what Albo and Labor really, really need to do, and I really hope someone from Labor is watching this, to be completely honest with you, what they need to do is they need to get in a room together, and they need to come up with a plan, an alternative plan, a plan that creates jobs, a plan that creates a secure future for households, and a plan that's inspiring for people that we're gonna beat this and get back on the path to growth, and we're gonna do it sustainably. We're not just gonna throw more debt at the economy. We're not just gonna, you know, do the same irresponsible and stupid things that made us arrive at this situation in the first place. And I think something like that, something incredibly broad, something incredibly detailed, would really put a lot of pressure on the Morrison government, because right now all people see is "Wee, free money." And that's all they're going to see until Labor provide an actual alternative. And at the end of the day, that's their job. Their job is to be an alternative government. And with speculation that we could see an early election as early as August next year, they really need to get their stuff together.
Right, because otherwise they will just be a small target mirror of what the other side's doing, because there will be very little differentiation.
Well, exactly. And in a lot of ways, it's going to be even worse than that, because, you know, small target strategy can work. It has worked quite well in the past. But if you're a small target of basically, just like you say, a reflection of the government, of where there's actually very little in the way of major changes in terms of the economy, because at the end of the day, that's what people care about now. You know, Labor can say, oh, but we're going to be more responsible on climate change. I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but right now, most people don't care. They care about having a job. They care about keeping a roof over their head. They care about looking after their children. And Labor need to adapt to that environment. Otherwise, like you say, they're just going to be this poor reflection in a mirror, and they're going to get smashed again.
Mm. So that really then should be talking to not just the volume of jobs, but the quality of the jobs and the nature of the jobs and what's surrounding them, which actually then takes them right back to what should be their home territory, which is about the way that you know project people in the work environment and all of those things. That, of course, is something which they really have peddled away from quite recently.
Yeah, Labor has sort of been in limbo for ever since the election.
Mm.
You know, there hasn't really been a whole lot, and what we have seen has really been sort of a moderated continuation of what we saw under Shorten. You know, Albo really hasn't united the party behind him in the way Shorten did. And I think that's really quite telling. You know, people give Shorten a lot of crap, and a lot of it's justified, but a lot of it isn't. What Shorten managed to do is, unlike Rudd and Gillard before him, who saw the party completely implode under them multiple times, he managed to hold Labor together. He managed to stop them from fighting with each other and focus on their effort as the opposition. But Albo hasn't managed that.
Mm.
You know, there's a lot of dissent within the party. There's a lot of different competing ideas, and a lot of them are still quite shell-shocked about their loss. And there's this sort of debate that's going on not only within the Labor Party, but I feel like it even goes on in the minds of people who are part of the party as well, of where did it go wrong? What do we need to do different? And I don't think they've quite come to a conclusion yet.
Well, isn't it really, I guess, on both sides of politics, the question that we should be asking is real leadership. We've touched on this a few times, right, in terms of, you know, at a time of crisis, a time of difficulty, then we need leadership that's real and tangible, not just marketing bullshit or, frankly, just trying to keep everybody, you know, sweet and carry on. That's not going to solve anything, is it?
No. But at the end of the day, I think part of the problem is to be completely honest with you, over the last two decades, as you say, the marketing bullshit has worked. You know, I mean, Jesus, Scott Morrison's prime minister, Scotty from marketing, for God's sake, you know, like he's not like, if you put Scott Morrison back in time, say, oh, let's say sort of 15, 20 years, he wouldn't get anywhere in the Howard government. You know, he'd be a junior minister and that's it, you know, and people would just look at him and go, no, he's not fit to stand in sort of, you know, Howard's shadow. And I think that's part of the problem as well at this point, is that if you compare the current crop of politicians to those who have gone before them, if you compare, say, you know, Morrison with Howard, you compare Albo with Keating or Hawke, there's no comparison. You know, it's like comparing a Lamborghini and a clapped out VN Commodore. There's just nothing in it. You know, it's just completely a whitewash. And I feel like that's part of the problem at the moment. And because the leaders, relatively speaking, compared to the way things were before, are so weak, there's none of this sort of grand ideas that sort of defined Australia. In previous generations, you know, it was like, oh, we're going to build Medicare, you know, we're going to build a nation of migrants, and we're going to make it one of the wealthiest countries in the world. You know, we had these grand, amazing visions for our future, you know, which we achieved as a nation, which we all got together, rolled up our sleeves, and we got done. You know, but I feel like we've sort of gone from what can your country do for you to, hey, I would like some more free money.
Yes. Well, it really is that bad, isn't it, insofar that if you ask me to try and articulate what the vision is for the next 20 years for Australia, I couldn't do it. I mean, you know, that is a really worrying statement, but I think it's probably true. I mean, all we could say is, well, we're going to build some more houses and we're going to export some more minerals and we're going to spend our way out of a problem. And that's about it. And that's not a vision, is it?
No, but I mean, that's the thing. The thing is that, you know, you say you can't articulate the vision, but the problem is you just did. That is the vision.
Oh dear. You know, I mean, that's a vision.
Well, I didn't say it was a good one. You know, that's the vision. It's just, let's get back to the way things were before and crack a beer, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's such a broken situation that I never really thought we'd arrive at. You know, I mean, I remember watching Question Time as a kid and thinking, you know, wow, you know, these, you know, sort of giants of politics are running our country. And now I look at the way things are and it's just profoundly broken. And, you know, to be completely honest with you, accountability is realistically gone, you know, in for anything other than the sort of most heinous of screw ups. You know, you've got sports rorts, you've got the issues with the sales and the distribution of the water licenses and all that other sort of stuff that's just that would realistically ruin political careers and potentially even bring down governments in days gone by. But I think we've actually spoken about this before, but I just feel like people have switched off. You know, they don't care anymore, because at the end of the day, the government's not working for them. They're working for them, you know, they're realistically working for themselves. I mean, you know, I've been droning on about this for a couple of years now, but, you know, we have 116,000 homeless people in this country. You know, we have 500,000 people waiting for drug and rehab beds, you know, and Jesus, you know, we are one of the wealthiest countries in the world, but we can't afford to address an exploding number of homeless people. I know that people are going to watch this and they're going to think that there are all these various different ideological angles to this problem. And I get that. I do. You know, I have people in my family who would vote for Donald Trump. But at the end of the day, we are a wealthy country and we should be addressing these problems And now we can debate how they should be addressed. We can talk about getting people into work rather than, you know, a lifetime of welfare dependence or a lifetime of dependence on social housing or whatever it is. But we should at least be having the conversation about how to address the problem rather than just ignoring it and going, oh, hey, we're going to go give 25 grand to wealthy people to renovate their houses while we have people who don't have a house.
Mm. Well, it does come back to what is Australia for and what is society for? And, you know, it goes back to, well, you have to measure the right things to be able to get the right outcomes. And so if you're only measuring, going back to the GDP conversation, if you're only measuring expansion of activity, then you're not going to be focusing in on those critical capabilities that are required to lift the level of life experience and therefore, you know, society as a whole. And it can, that's what I come back to. So it seems to me that society should be more about than just GDP. It is much more about making sure that we've got a degree of equity and a degree of fairness in society, but also the right level of supports for those who are more disadvantaged, because that should be a measure of what society is. And as you say, particularly when we're such an affluent country relative to many others, and yet we do seem to have lost the plot.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I grew up in a low socioeconomic area. You know, I've seen what that sort of thing does to people. You know, the issues with drugs, the issues with mental health, you know, and all and crime and all manner of things. And it concerns me that now that Australia is going to be seeing those problems, not just in places where people don't have a whole lot of money, you know, like places where I grew up, but across the country.
Yeah.
You know, and like, as you say, those things, those metrics need to be something that we talk about, need to be something that we use as a yardstick to say, okay, we have advanced, we have improved our country, rather than just looking at a headline GDP number from 10 years ago and saying, oh, look, it's grown. Yay. And it's just really a bit sad, to be honest with you.
Well, it's a reductionist view of the world, isn't it? It's a very narrow view of the world, and frankly, at the end of the day, it means that we're going to have more and more human casualties, basically on the altar of ever greater GDP. And for me, that doesn't feel right, and I don't think that makes a lot of economic sense either, actually, by the way.
No, and to use an incredibly overused term, I think it's downright un-Australian, to be completely honest with you.
Right.
You know, we've got these ideas about what it means to be Australian, about Simpson's donkey and, you know, everyone, mates looking after each other and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, in years gone by, perhaps, you know, I think that was a lot more true than it is now. And I think that that's something that we really need to aspire to, you know, to be better, to achieve more for our country, and to be able to look at ourselves in the mirror and say, we did good, we did better. You know, we planted a tree so the future generations could sit in the shade of that tree and then enjoy a better world.
Right. And I think that's the key point to take away from today, is that now is the time to be articulating more of a vision for the future, not just the next 12 months or 18 months, but essentially more aspirational, but also to use a different set of metrics and a different set of lenses to be able to actually identify better what the true actions should be, rather than actually just being driven by a very narrow economic platform, which has actually clearly failed over the last decade.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that people really need to sort of keep in mind and not be sucked into is, when we compare ourselves, we need to compare ourselves to the way we were in the past, into how far we've come, in a very, very serious and statistical and methodical way to look at it. But I find, like, what happens at the moment, even when I sort of talk to politically engaged and even, you know, very educated people, is we compare ourselves to America.
Mm.
We compare ourselves to the rest of the world and we go, at least we're not that. At least we're not a train wreck that is, you know, a train wreck full of nuclear waste that is currently on fire, you know. And that's not good enough. You know, we can't just look across the Pacific at the Americans and think, holy crap, I'm glad that we don't have riots in our streets and we don't have the virus, you know, sort of a lot more out of control than it is here. That shouldn't be enough for us.
No, you know? Well, no, that's right. Because effectively, if you are defining yourself by a negative of another template, which is what often people are doing, then what you're missing is the opportunity to create something, you know, even more powerful. And I, you know, I've got a very positive view of what Australia could be, because, you know, there are so many good things here and there are so many good things that we could do, but only if we get the right vision and the right leadership and the right perspectives. And frankly, without those, then this is going to be a very, very difficult grind over the next maybe decade.
Absolutely. And I think that's what really gets me. Like, you know, people like you and me, really, we get tarred with the bearish brush. It's like, oh, you're always so negative, you know, you'll never say, have anything to say, positive to say. Well, here we go. Something positive. I have a lot of faith in Australia and the Australian people. Mm-hmm. We can achieve, you know, basically whatever we set our minds to. You know, we can create a better country for our children and a better country for ourselves. We can do this if we choose to. You know, we need to force our political class into doing something different rather than just this small target crap where they just do the same thing over and over again and hope for a different outcome, which is, I think, which is, you know, Einstein's definition of insanity. And, you know, we can do better. We have so much potential in this country. We have one of the most educated populaces on the face of the earth. You know, we're blessed with amazing natural resources, which we sell, and we don't really have to do that much to be better, to have a, you know, and not only that, but because of the way our political system has functioned, we have really low government debt. You know, by the time we get to a similar debt level to the rest of the world, we could build, you know, a veritable utopia relative to what's unfolding around the globe. Now, I know that there's going to be challenges and things are going to be difficult and people are going to suffer. And, you know, that's the reality of a recession. And, you know, I feel for those people. I really do, you know, but at the end of the day, we need to look at things for what they are, not what we want them to be. And then we build the world that we want. And that's the end of my, what's turned into a campaign rally.
Well, I'm just cheering here in the background, but it is, look, there's two points to close on. Firstly, yeah, you have to have a clear objective of where you want to get to, because if you don't have that, then anywhere's okay, right? So that's why the vision thing is important. And the second thing, I was talking to a very well-known writer the other day about the fact that a lot of this starts with a mental attitude, right? So, you know, rather than just saying, oh, it's all terrible and it's, you know, somebody else's problem, it's actually about your own attitude and about you know, turning around and saying, we can do this, right? And I think we need a bit more of that, particularly now, because otherwise I think this is going to be a very, very, you know, uncomfortable ride. But on the other hand, there is a huge potential, if it could be harnessed, to take us to something very exciting. And, you know, I'm not a bear on that. I actually think that is a real opportunity. We could go grab it.
Yeah. I think you hit at a very important point. It's about agency. It's about control. It's about taking control of our own destiny rather than just, you know, continuing to ride, you know, China's coattails or continuing to ride the wealth effect as we have in the past, you know, sort of couple of decades. And I think that's what really needs to happen. We need a leader to get up and say, you know, we're in this together. You know, there was going to be hardship. We're going to make sacrifices, but we're going to do it together. And by giving people a mission, by giving people that sort of control and decision-making over the future of the country, rather than just people looking on television and going, oh, look, they stuffed up again. You know, by having that control, that's really important. You know, it's what people did during the war. You know, they turned around and they said, you know, you need to do your part. You know, you need to make do and mend. You need to, you know, walk instead of taking a car so we've got fuel for our tanks. You know, when we need that sort of shared viewpoint of a future. And I think that that's not only just important for an economic recovery, but as you say, with all these other metrics, I think it's important for a better society, for us to be able to have something. Because when we do accomplish this, when we do recover, maybe instead of just going back to the way things were before, maybe we should turn around and go, okay, we fixed that problem together. What else can we fix? What else can we improve? And on that, I completely agree with you. I'm very positive that that is possible if people make that decision to make that a reality.
Yep. So we need a Churchill Mark II to step up, step out, and there is an opportunity.
Absolutely. You know, we just need someone to do it. But and not only that, but if the politicians aren't willing to, maybe we need to start up our own groups, our own things, to be able to either, you know, lobby them into it, or we'll just do it ourselves.
Yeah. Well, Tarek, it's always an interesting conversation with you because on one hand, you and I see things quite similarly, but also there are some very interesting, pen pictures that we can paint when we chat. So I really appreciate your time today. And congratulations on the new mic, by the way. It sounds great.
Oh, I'm glad. I know a few people were rather unhappy with it, so I'm glad that people will be able to hear me a little bit more clearly.
Great. We'll chat again soon and take care.
You too, mate. Bye.